Welcome to the AFP Report. This is your host, John Friend. Today is Friday, May 27th, 2022. This is the 13th edition of the AFP Report, a podcast series where I will be interviewing reporters and contributors to American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, as well as other special guests. Please consider subscribing to American Free Press if you are not already. Subscription details can be found at AmericanFreePress.net. And today I'm joined by Don Jeffries, a well-respected author, investigator, and regular contributor to American Free Press. All right, Don Jeffries, welcome to the program, sir. How are you today?
Oh, fine, John. It's great to be back.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. We've got a lot to cover, lots of news and developments as always. And we just sent to the printer issue 23 and 24 of American Free Press, which includes the American Free Press Spring and Summer 2022 book catalog. And there are a ton of new books for sale, so I encourage listeners to, of course, check those out and pick up a book or two or more. And also, of course, please do consider subscribing to American Free Press if you are not already. Details can be found at AmericanFreePress.net. And Don, I wanted to start out and briefly touch on a topic that we discussed last time you were on the program, and that was a couple weeks ago, and that is home ownership in America and how difficult it is for the younger generations, millennials and Zoomers, and I guess really, you know, anybody trying to purchase a home, you know, in this day and age, which has always been, you know, like considered a key aspect of the American dream. I came across a couple of recent articles published at Statista.com, which is a great website, a great source of information if you're not familiar with it. They sort of specialize in informational charts and graphs, and they cover a lot of very interesting and important topics. And an article published just yesterday is titled "New Home Sales Plunge in Face of Surging Costs." And let me just read briefly an excerpt here. Sales of new single-family houses dropped for the fourth consecutive month in the United States as potential home buyers face a perfect storm of unfavorable conditions. According to figures jointly released by the U.S. Census Bureau and the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, new home sales fell to a seasonally adjusted annual rate of 591,000 in April, the lowest it's been since April 2020, when the COVID-19 pandemic left markets flooded with uncertainty. And it talks about how new home sales dropped over 16% in April, while home prices continued to trend upward, which I don't see how that is possible. I don't know how much longer this is going to go on, but home prices seem to continue to grow, and demand for housing seems to be falling. And I'm sure there's a number of factors at play, but I think it's getting more and more difficult for people to even qualify for a loan, especially with home prices continuing to grow like this. It's crazy.
Right. And you know, I've said many times, you know, that the housing industry is really the only, and I mean the only thing in this country that's not collapsing. Everything else is trending downwards. There's really a crisis in everything in terms of inflation, infrastructure, culturally, any way you want to look at it. But
the stock market's been taking major hits lately.
Absolutely. Crypto, all that, everything that you would turn to. But for some reason, the housing industry, and it's an anomaly. And as you mentioned, I don't see how it can stand, especially interest rates are rising again, which they've been, you know, have been trending downwards for years. And now they've been rising again. I don't know how that can help the housing industry, but just to show you how insane this is, and I've been licensed as a realtor since 1985. So, excuse me, I've seen a lot of, a lot of different markets come and go. But recently, a house in our neighborhood sold for $150,000 above the list price. Now, I can't tell you how unbelievable that is. Again, 1985, that is unprecedented. And
But that's happening everywhere.
Yes, yes.
That's happening everywhere. Right. California, New York, all across the country.
And it's insane. I mean, I'm telling you, it never – you had bidding wars during hot markets and – you know, maybe a house would sell for 20, maybe 30,000, but 150,000. I mean, that's a huge, that means the person that was attempting to buy it either had a whole lot much more cash to put down or qualified for a loan amount that was $150,000 over what this particular loan was going to be for that house. I never heard anything like this. I don't even know how to analyze it, but it shows you how insane the situation is. But I think it's, again, like my book, The Survival of the Richest, I use that 80-20 split. We have a casino economy. Casinos work on the basis that 20% of the people win, so 80% of the people have to lose. In America, about 20% of the people win to varying degrees. Now, of course, the ones at the absolute top are winning. You know, they're just absconding with all the wealth. But 80% of the people have to lose to one degree or another. The bottom 50% lose totally. And they have bottom half of this country has less than 1% of the collective wealth. You can't have an economy with half the country with nothing. And that's what
this is like a third world. Yeah. It's like, absolutely. Third world level situation, right. We're getting to. Are you familiar with a gentleman on YouTube? His channel is, his name is Jeremiah Babe.
I don't think so.
Okay, you might want to check him out. He's really, really interesting. He does a lot of videos. He's out in Southern California, and he talks a lot about the economy, about the stock market, about, you know, housing prices, retail, all these sorts of issues. And you know, he's a guy that I put on, you know, I'll watch on YouTube every couple of days. I'll catch up with all his videos. And you know, he covers this issue very well, and it's amazing. I mean, the interest rate for mortgages has basically doubled. I think a year ago it was just under 3%. Now it's over 5%. So I'm sorry, it hasn't quite doubled, but it's risen significantly, and that is having a huge impact on just your average mortgage price, right? I mean, you could go from paying say $1,000 a month on an average mortgage to, with this increased rate, maybe you're paying $1,400 now. Maybe you're paying $1,500 now, which is very, very difficult for a lot of people.
It is, but it is as indicative of what happened in my neighborhood and is happening elsewhere. The people that are buying decent homes have a lot of they're doing well. They're winners. So the interest rate rise doesn't necessarily – they can pay $400 more a month. But again, it's a very small group. Most people in this country are 70 some percent live paycheck to paycheck. I've said that, you know, I've talked about those statistics many times. About the same percentage have less than $1,000 of savings in the bank.
So that's crazy to think about.
It's nuts. And so you can't have a viable economy like that, but it's showing up in real estate. And I don't know how much longer. Basically, real estate is being kept afloat on some kind of artificial respiration, because there's not enough buyers to go around to buy these homes. The ones that do now, what I'm concerned about, and I wonder what happened in my neighborhood elsewhere, is if we do know that BlackRock and Chinese investors are buying up a lot of properties. Now, is this happening? How often is this happening? I don't know. I wasn't involved in that deal, but I wonder, you know,
it would certainly go along with this whole World Economic Forum idea of, you know, owning nothing. You know, everyone is going to own nothing and they're going to be happy. And when you see, you know, housing prices like this and just the inability for just an average person to buy a home these days, it really sort of dovetails perfectly with that sort of globalist elitist agenda. And with companies like BlackRock stepping in and purchasing residential, you know, private homes like this, it's, you know, it makes it much more difficult for an average person to go out and buy a house.
Yeah, and it fits in the traditional American dream. And again, as a former – I'm still a realtor, but as someone who was more active in it, we used to preach all the time. This is really an essential part of the American dream is homeownership. Although, you know, you really never actually own your home. You're still paying taxes on it, property taxes. We can talk about that, you know, why that is. And a law of eminent domain, they can still come and take your property if you don't, you know, go along with the new highway or whatever. But still, you own your property, at least to some capacity. It's better than paying someone else's mortgage and paying rent. But the idea was, when my wife and I first got married, we both blue collar workers and very, you know, young. And we bought a townhouse, a very small townhouse right next to the railroad tracks that we scraped and, you know, barely had enough to get. I think the interest rate was 10% at the time, but we paid like $71,000. And we were able to, you know, sell it for a little over 100,000 13 years later. And again, the market was much slower in appreciating then. And we ended up getting a single family home. Now, since we've been in here, we have hundreds of thousands of dollars in equity. But all of that is, you know, that's kind of like, you know, the funny money with the fiat currency we see everywhere else, because equity is an imaginary thing because it only exists as long as the market is at that level. It's like the stock market. So, yeah, it's great having that kind of equity, but unless you turn it into just getting another loan out, a cash equity loan or something, it's really it's illusory, especially if you, when you sell the house, you're going to have to buy something else and everything's gone up. So it's nice, but so I like the fact that our price is going up because it increases our net worth, but it makes it harder for my children to ever buy a house. And that's what I'm concerned about, because you can, it can only go up so much, and you can't have a market. I mean, the houses in my subdivision are very close. If it keeps going up like this in another year or less, they're going to be $1 million. And, you know, I do not live in a $1 million house. It's ridiculous. But that's what's happening in good neighborhoods. And so, but we don't, my neighborhood, neighborhoods like this, and I've talked about this before too, home ownership, the suburbs, you know, the idea, that's what made America great, the middle class and suburbs. You know, people having kind of the best of both worlds, where you live, I live, you know, 20 minutes from Washington, D.C. So you can still live close to the city and experience that, but you're in a quiet suburb. I mean, I can hear a pin drop when I walk through, I take my daily walk around the neighborhood every day, and I cherish that. But I also know the powers that be despise that. They don't want peace and quiet. They don't want you to have that existence, and they really, really resent it. So I know they're coming for us. I don't know how they're
absolutely gonna... Well, they want basically peasants and serfs and people that are just unable to actually own property. And home ownership has been a key component of you know, sort of economic mobility in America. Yes. And you know, when you know, you're simply unable to purchase a home, you know, are you ever going to be genuinely, you know, wealthy or have any sort of significant economic power? Okay. Probably not, right? I mean, it's severely diminished, obviously.
No, and when you factor in the increased cost of, I mean, the cost of living is based around the most basic items, and obviously housing is the first one. Food would be the second. Gasoline, all utilities, all of these costs. We see what's happening across the board to all these. So not only do you have, I mean, used cars. It's incredible how used cars, I mean, they used to joke, you know, the used car is a horrible investment to have. Not anymore. So, you know, I don't guess I'll be buying any more cars, because I'm just going to, I guess, keep what I have. And I guess they're going to keep appreciating in value. It's insanity what's happening, and nobody's doing anything to stop anything
right
wrong in this country.
Well, you'd think that this would be, you know, like a primary concern for a government that actually cared about the people and cared about the well-being of the people, right?
Right.
But no, meanwhile, our government has billions of dollars for Ukraine, billions of dollars for dangerous, untested, totally unnecessary vaccines, billions of dollars for Israel and the military-industrial complex and foreign aid, billions of dollars for Wall Street and the big banks, but nothing to help the average American or the average American small business in a time of crushing economic problems, as you've sort of explained. Did you know that the same day that the Senate passed the $40 billion Ukraine aid package, they blocked passage of a $48 billion aid package for restaurants and small businesses, the hardest hit by the lockdown policies and all these other unconstitutional measures implemented by governments in response to the fake COVID pandemic? Does that not show you the priorities of our totally criminal government?
Absolutely. And but again, you know, I'm to the point now where that's why in my recent blog, I write at Substack, and people can read me over there, and I'm getting a much bigger following there. And I wrote something about the John Doe movement, one of my favorite films of all time, Meet John Doe from Frank Capra. Urge everyone to watch that. It's real populism. You see what's possible with that. But anyhow, the John Doe movement was based on the golden rule, love thy neighbor, and just basically built no politics, just built around try to be nice to each other, try to be good neighbors. Just simple concept. And it took the film took over the nation by fire, and I think it would in reality too. But I'm almost to that point where I'm beyond politics, because I don't know what can you do. I mean, look at the guy in Georgia, Kemp, the governor. I mean, if the Republicans are really an alternative party, this guy was at the center of all the vote fraud, of allowing it and enabling it as the governor of the state. He did everything he could to block an honest election. And he's got 70-some percent of the vote in the primary against some candidate that Trump – I don't know if the guy Trump backed was any good or not. I'm surprised Trump didn't back Kemp because that's what he usually does. But so I don't know if it'd be the other – but certainly this guy isn't any good. And I fear you're going to see that again. You're going to see 90-plus percent of these incumbents return it. And that's why you have two choices here, and both of them are bad. One is that, as I suspect, they're not counting the votes. It's completely fraud. They just, as Mark Twain said a long time ago, if voting to change anything would be illegal. I'm really of that frame of mind at this point. They're not going to let us vote our way out of it. But the other choice is even worse. And that is maybe they don't have to even rig the vote most of the time because the American people are so stupid that they can't stop themselves from reelecting these clowns. I mean, do we really? So that's why there's nothing. What is going to change? One of the most profound thing Donald Trump said during his very strong 2016 campaign, where he said lots of great stuff and he won my vote. He wasn't sincere, but he won my vote. And the best thing he said was the system is rigged and you don't trust those who rigged it to fix it. The American people, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, they're trusting the people that rigged it to fix it. So on the Republican side, you're not going to trust the governor of Georgia to do anything different. You're not going to trust Mitch McConnell, who will be reelected. Lindsey Graham will be. I mean, all these people will be reelected. And you know somebody there, somehow Nancy Pelosi will be reelected. I would love to interview these voters. Why? Look at the state of the country. It's completely collapsing everywhere. Why are you reelecting the people and keeping them in charge? People that rigged it.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Lindsey Graham, all of these career politicians are just total traitors, total stooges, total puppets. It's really disgraceful. And you know what? We'll get a little bit more into that topic as we proceed here. I do want to actually talk about the front page article in this current issue of American Free Press, which again just went to the printer and will be mailed out starting next Monday. Well, actually, if it's Memorial Day, it might not go out on Monday. So maybe next Tuesday, now that I think about it. But the headline is Globalists Gather in Davos, Vow to Crush Russia and Putin. Don, have you been following anything that's been going on at this Davos 2022 meeting?
Well, a little bit, but I'm familiar with what their agenda is, so we know what they want. And yeah. Again, I'm still not sold on, again, Putin. I don't know if Putin's real or not. I mean, I don't know. You know, I've seen pictures of him with Klaus Schwab. I don't know. He could be like Trump, you know, where he's a fake right. opposition. I really know he's a lot of the quotes I've read from him are great, but they're coming from alternative sources. I don't know if those are true or not, but I don't know that there are any good guys, but certainly Davos and all that. But aren't they all involved? I don't know who's not involved.
Well, Russia has been basically excluded from the World Economic Forum.
Okay.
Because of this war in Ukraine. So like the whole world is like united against Russia. Mm-hmm. It's very reminiscent of what happened to National Socialist Germany leading right. up to World War II. Right. And you're right. I'm not totally convinced that Putin is the real deal. He definitely seems a lot more honest and trustworthy and intelligent than the clowns that we have in America, or like yes. at the World Economic Forum. He's on a whole other level.
Yes.
So I do tend to trust him a little bit more. Let me just briefly read some of this article. There's some incredible quotes that came out of Davos, okay. and I'm just barely scratching the surface here. But I start out writing here, in between sessions dedicated to combating climate change, ensuring environmental sustainability, promoting diversity and inclusion, and preparing for the next pandemic, the global power elite attending the World Economic Forum's Davos 2022 meeting in Switzerland in late May were united on maintaining the American-centric, unipolar world order established in the aftermath of World War II. And scarily, they seem intent and united on crushing any nation challenging that order. That was the main takeaway on the international relations front. I go on to quote Senator Joe Manchin, another one of these totally traitorous, yeah. ridiculous politicians from West Virginia. He's a Democrat from West Virginia. He was up there at Davos basically saying that he wanted to see Ukraine end with a win, not a negotiated settlement, not any sort of peace talks or any sort of like rational dialogue. Ukraine needs a total victory. And Russia needs to be pushed back, and Putin ultimately needs to be gotten rid of. That's basically what this guy mm-hmm. said publicly at this forum. And you know, this sort of like echoes weeks of just reckless comments that have been coming out of U.S. politicians and pundits. We had guys like Sean Hannity openly calling for Putin's assassination. Lindsey Graham was saying similar things. So, I mean, the elite in the United States and in the EU and in NATO and at Davos, they are united in crushing Russia. The European Union the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen also gave a speech. The head of the NATO, Director General of NATO, gave a speech, and they're all talking about how we're all uniting with Ukraine and we're standing up to Russia. Von der Leyen was saying that Ukraine must win this war. Putin's aggression must be a strategic failure. We will do everything we can to help Ukrainians prevail. Things like this. Of course, Zelensky spoke. We've talked about Zelensky in previous podcasts. He's like this this darling of the Western press and political class. He's this Jewish crisis actor, basically.
Yeah.
That you know, has been installed as president of Ukraine, and he's been extremely reckless with his rhetoric and hostility towards Russia. And from what I can tell, the Ukrainians are basically getting their butts kicked left and right all over the country. So I don't know. I really don't know what they're thinking. But he was at Davos again with his typical talking points, calling for boycotts, calling for more sanctions, calling for a full oil embargo, totally cutting Russian banks off from the international system. Basically, more escalation. More. We need more weaponry. We need more support. These sorts of things. George Soros may have had the most interesting statements to make, though. He gave a speech, and I read the whole thing and took some quotes out. Very, very interesting. He was basically saying that this Russian invasion may have initiated World War III and that our civilization may not survive it. And he went on to describe the emerging conflict as one between open societies, such as the United States and the European Union, and closed societies like Russia and China. And he said that China and Russia present the greatest threat to open societies, and that the best and perhaps only way to preserve our civilization is to defeat Putin. So if guys like George Soros and the whole EU and the American political and media establishment are uniting to condemn you, you got to be doing something right. You're certainly not playing ball. You're certainly not playing ball with them.
He has the right enemies, that's for sure.
Well, exactly, yeah, and that's crystal clear at this Davos 2022 meeting. Go ahead if you want to comment.
Yeah, no, I think you could say the same thing about Trump too. You know, that he has the right enemies, and that's always been the best thing about Trump. But certainly, Putin, I don't. And again, somebody who studied history, and I've written about this a lot, it's astonishing to me to see change that's taken place on the left, and the same left that did everything they could to enable Soviet aggression back in the day when the Soviet Union really was dangerous and they really were taking over countries all over the world. All we heard from the left at that time was detente. I'm always for that. I'm always for diplomacy. So I would have agreed with that. But it's interesting to see now that Russia has, however you look at it, they certainly, nobody can claim they're anywhere near what they were as the Soviet Union. And they appear to be trying to open up. I mean, I don't know if it's true about Putin opening up a lot of churches in Russia to Christianize Russia. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's what you hear. And he certainly, the statements I hear from him make a lot more sense than what we hear from our leaders. So however you look at it, this is a very, really a horrific situation. And if Putin is being treated to a hatred that really only rivals, I think, worldwide what we saw with Hitler and Trump. So maybe every time they decide to resurrect a boogeyman or a hobgoblin, you know, what H.L. Mencken said, an endless series of hobgoblins, that's what forms our foreign policy. When they decide to do this, I guess they're going to go all in on it now. They started with Trump and now Putin, where you're seeing, because Putin is experienced, I think, a vitriol that you didn't see with previous hobgoblins like Saddam Hussein or Osama bin Laden. I mean, they were hated.
Right. But it's not on a whole other level, yeah.
Yes.
Well, and they've been after Putin for a very long time. They've been hysterically demonizing Putin as like the next Adolf Hitler going back years. I mean, back to, you know, like 2014, 2013, you know, following the initial Maidan coup. I mean, even back then, even prior to that, really, for the past 20 years or so, they've been really demonizing Putin as this like evil monster that wants to take over the world. And, you know, this just ridiculous, childish rhetoric that you hear from the West. And also lately, there's been a really demonization of China as well. Did you see Joe Biden's comments earlier this week?
Yeah.
When he was in Japan. Yeah, he was giving a press conference.
He would have involved in militarily to defend Taiwan. Is that what he said?
That's the commitment we made. Yeah. I mean, this guy is such a fool. His whole administration is extremely dangerous. I mean, the rhetoric is just out of control. I mean, these people have no idea what they're doing. Well, maybe they do know what they're doing, and they're just that crazy. I mean, it is a bunch of Jewish neocons basically leading this administration.
Yeah.
So, and these people just want total world control, and they will freak out at anybody even challenging it in the slightest way.
Yeah, well, I've always said, you know, that I don't. That's why when people talked about Putin and the Russia and the Ukraine, I said I don't care if Putin's a good guy or a bad guy. I don't know because I don't trust the people that analyze foreign leaders in this country are the same intelligence agencies that probably killed JFK and still lie about everything. Why would I trust them that have gotten us in all these no-win absurd conflicts where they've committed war crimes galore? And so you have people like Manning and Assange and Snowden that are, you know, still exiled because they're trying to expose some of the stuff that they were doing. Why would I believe anything they say? So I have no idea what is going on in any country. I'm sure there's lots of bad places. I'm sure there's some nasty things going on that we would look at and say, wow. But I'm looking at my own country, and my enemies are not in China. They're not in Russia. They're not anywhere. Wherever you want to talk about, they're in Washington, D.C.
Absolutely.
At least the ones that we can see. I mean, we know there are people above them that are the puppet masters orchestrating it, but the ones we can see, the ones that portend to be our leaders, that's why I concentrate on that. I don't care about China or Russia or anybody. I don't care what they say they're doing. I know what you guys are doing. I know what you're doing, what you just did, what you mentioned, a perfect example of giving $40 billion to the Ukraine when America is collapsing, where you have in our cities, you have people literally crapping in the streets and they're not even cleaning it up anymore. You have tent cities everywhere. Cost of living is, whether it's what we talked about with housing, food, anything else, they are inventing maybe a fourth world. I mean, this is, considering the wealth we have, I don't even think we classify as a third world, because the amount of wealth most people don't know. And I talked about it in the updated paperback edition of Survival of the Richest. When that came out, I found a statistics that I found amazing. If you divided up all the wealth in America, now again, I'm not suggesting we do that. I'm not a socialist. But I am a populist, and just it gives you an idea how much wealth is there. It'd be every man, woman, and child would get, I think it was $341,000 each. So it'd be like Huey Long said, every family would be a king anyhow. So I'm not suggesting you do that. And that's just the known wealth. That's without auditing the Federal Reserve. That's without auditing all the offshore profits. Without auditing the Gates Foundation, the Clinton Foundation, the Rock, all these foundations that have untold amounts of wealth and they've never been audited, just like the Federal Reserve. So there's a lot more money even than that, probably trillions more that we don't know about. But just the known wealth, every man, woman, and child would have over $300,000 each. Imagine, I mean, of course, that would never be allowed to happen, but I just use that statistic to show people how much money, how sinfully rich America is. And look at what we've done with it. I mean, it's amazing. Our streets are – we haven't addressed the infrastructure for 60 years. Our internet is slower. I used to work with a guy from the Dominican Republic, and every time he'd go back to his country, he'd say, I can't wait to get back to faster internet. Our internet is slower than countries like the Dominican Republic. That's inexcusable. How do people – even possibly accept that, but you try to tell the average citizen that and they give you that blank look and they go back to their cell phone. And if they go to the polls, I'm more and more convinced that I know that they obviously can rig elections. I don't know that they need to most of the time. I think they're confident that the American people are so stupid that they will always vote for the worst of two evils, not the lesser of two evils. And you see the results. I mean, the proof is in the pudding.
Right. Yeah, no, that's true. That's a good point. Well, what's interesting is, I mean, ever since this Russian special military operation against Ukraine and the policies that we've seen come out of D.C. and out of Brussels and London, all these sanctions against Russia, everything is like totally backfired on the West. The ruble is like sky high. It's like never been stronger. The Russian economy is booming. Their foreign reserves are up tremendously, even though much of them have been basically confiscated and stolen by Western governments and Western financial institutions. So, like, everything has backfired, and it's only strengthened the Russian-Chinese alliance. I mean, the Chinese and Russians are basically saying that they have the most strategic alliance. Nothing will come between these two countries. So clearly, this is a rising alliance that could potentially challenge this America-centric world order. And that is what has these people scared to death about. And that's why we see this hysteria on full display. And that's what this Davos meeting is all about. It's about, you know, uniting the world against Russia. And, you know, I don't know. It's really revealing. I think that for sure it's really revealing what is going on in the world and what the agenda is. But as you said, it's who knows if the American people are going to actually recognize it for what it is.
Yeah, and whatever happens, we know that I don't make any predictions. I after Trump was elected in 2016, I said I'm not trying to make any more predictions. I have no idea what's going on, obviously, and I still don't. I mean, but I do know that one thing you can take to the bank is that whatever happens, it will be a continuation of decimating average people. Whatever will happen will be bad for the great mass of people and great for the elite. And that's what everything that happens is done under those pretexts. How can we twist it and rig it even more so that those who already have everything get more and that those that are already struggling continue to struggle more? Let's keep asking them for sacrifice. Well, we never sacrifice anything. You see it all the time. I saw Matthew McConaughey, another idiot celebrity running for governor of Texas, again, talking about that people may have to sacrifice. I talked about this in Survival of the Richest. I'm so sick. I showed all the quotes from Obama and every other politician basically asking. And of course they're asking you and me to sacrifice. They're asking people to sacrifice that already have no room to sacrifice. And they're not going to sacrifice anything. You stop taking your hot showers. You don't drive an SUV. You do all this stuff. Meanwhile, I'll fly off in my private jet. And I'll leave a huge carbon footprint that I'm lecturing you about. It's the hypocrisy.
Yeah. That's so true. That's the most amazing thing about this Davos 2022 meeting is that like one of their big issues is, I mean, it seems to be mostly focused around the situation in Ukraine and the right, you know, like the threat of China, but also the pandemic. But to a lesser extent, it's this, fighting climate change, sustainable development, promoting diversity and inclusion and stuff like that. And meanwhile, it's all these like billionaire elites flying on private jets, taking private vehicles, traveling thousands of miles away to attend this conference. I mean, the hypocrisy is so stunning and insulting, yeah, you know, absolutely. Just on the face of it. It's incredible.
Yeah. And they never get tired of the hypocrisy. I mean, no matter how many times it's thrown back in their faces, they have an unending thirst, you know, to basically show how hypocritical they are. And they have no shame. None. I mean, how could you, I can't even imagine it to be like a movie star or like Leonardo DiCaprio or somebody like that, the people that have done this and flying in to some conference or something on my private jet and going up and lecturing the common people about saving energy and doing, you know, people like Sheryl Crow saying, use two strips of paper, toilet paper. It's like, well, what? And, was it Jennifer Aniston saying you can brush your teeth and take a shower at the same time? What? I mean, does anybody really think these clueless one percenters are doing that? But again, people, they continue to go back to those people. That's why I don't support them at all. I don't go to their movies. I don't buy their music. I don't do it. And I did enough of that when I was younger, but I'm not going to support any of these people. And I'm not going to support them at the ballot box anymore. I'm sorry. Unless maybe Ron Paul runs again, not Rand, Ron Paul or something. I'm not going to vote for anybody. Again, unless you hear I don't know who that would even be, but there's nobody on the horizon. Trump was the last one. I said at the time when he ran, he was our last hope. Imperfect as he was the last hope with that rhetoric he had. And we saw what happened there. Nothing happened in 4 years. It's not going to change politically. It's only going to change within the American people. That's why I say we can try to be the best people we are. We can try to come together maybe under, you know, a John Doe type of thing where we can try to be nice to each other. And that just being nice and kind, that would spill over into maybe doing some honest things. But, I'm in my neck of the woods. I live right next. I used to work in Loudoun County, Virginia, and that's where the epicenter of the school board parent conflicts were. And I haven't heard. I said at the time, maybe we can make some change from the bottom up, maybe from the school board. We might be able to make some change there. I don't think we've affected any change, and I don't even hear anything. The parents must not be angry anymore, and why they're not angry, I don't know. But have you heard anything about that story? That story's died out, and it's very sad because that was really our only chance, maybe at that level. We know nothing can happen at the national level. 90%+ of these incumbents will be reelected again, and no one will question the fact that 90%+ of Congress is reelected every election. Well, at the same time, public opinion polls show they have like a 6% approval rating. Somebody explain that to me.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah,
there's exactly. Obviously no explanation for it.
Yeah, well, you know what? Let's move on. We got a few other stories that I want to cover here in this podcast. And you actually wrote about some recent developments with John Durham, the special prosecutor, investigating Hillary Clinton and the origins of this Russiagate hoax, which I think you could make a decent case that this whole Russiagate situation has actually led us to where we're at today with the situation in Ukraine and this hostility towards Russia. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really does go back that far. And the way Putin has been demonized, the way Russia has been demonized, and this totally concocted, totally ridiculous, like genuine conspiracy theory that the Clinton campaign came up with, took to the FBI, you know, leaked to the media.
Yeah.
Made it into this big, huge deal, all basically to derail and undermine the Trump presidency, which was very successful. And this special – I mean, frankly, I don't know why this wasn't investigated at the time. I mean, we're what?
Oh, that's the question, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, Trump –
five, 6 years, 7 years, 7 years after the fact, and we're just now barely getting into some actual prosecutions. Yeah.
Right. We have one prosecution of Michael Sussman, one of the attorneys for Hillary Clinton. And there's going to be one charge. And I wrote in the article about the jury selection process. First of all, it's taking place in Washington, D.C., and that's where the problem begins. Washington, D.C. votes 90%+ Democratic in every election. So right there, look at the jury pool you're dealing with. How are you possibly going to get an impartial jury? It's impossible. So the prosecution, unwisely, again, it reminded me of the O.J. prosecution case where that ridiculous Marsha Clark said, no, I want an all jury of all black women. I mean, just, again, virtue signaling, and you saw it blew up in her face. Same kind of thing here where the prosecution is bending over backwards. So you had I think they picked one juror that is on the record as being violently anti-Trump. There's another juror that talked about the system being racist. And supporting the Black Panthers, I think. And there's another one. I can't remember. There's a third one that was. But again, something totally ridiculous like that. And they're on the jury. So what are the – usually in federal prosecutions, the system is rigged against the defendant. So it's almost impossible not to win a federal prosecution. It's like 95% or something like that, conviction rate. It's kind of like the reelection rate for incumbents. It's a rigged system. But in this case, unfortunately, I think Durham has his work cut out for him because he's dealing with
it. It's like the opposite. Yeah, he's going against the deep state. These people are – this is like the epitome of the deep state and the way they operate. And this Sussman guy, he basically – he was a lawyer for the Clinton campaign, and he lied about the fact that he was like operating on behalf of the Clintons when he was – yeah, right. That's kind of like – that goes to like the heart of the situation.
Right.
And
–
But
it's a small – it's a very small charge. Even if they get him on it, it's not going to have any kind of ripple effect. They could easily more justly bring a prosecution against Hillary Clinton because they know from their boy John Brennan, the former CIA director alone. They have a CIA memo. I've written in American Free Press about it probably a couple years ago when Trump was still president. And again, his Justice Department did nothing about it under William Barr. They could have brought prosecution against Hillary Clinton. That would have shown, hey, we're serious about draining the swamp, because John Brennan talked openly in the CIMO about how Hillary has this concoction, you know, this scheme, basically, to try to blame Trump for colluding with Russia.
And it was all totally baseless and actually ridiculous that even, well, as you said, the CIA saw it for what it was. It was a politically motivated Dirty Tricks campaign, basically, to smear Trump and to tie him to the Russians. Yeah. And yeah, and it was very obvious that's exactly what it was. And the government knew that, basically, and yet allowed this to play out, allowed the media to continue to run with this narrative for years. You know, I mean, they were you still hear about it from time to time. It's absolutely outrageous. Meanwhile, guys that were actually close to Trump, like General Flynn, are actually getting prosecuted. Paul Manafort and others that were actually working
Stone,
for Trump.
Roger Stone?
Yeah, Roger Stone, the people at January 6th. I mean, it goes on and on and on. So it's like the criminals that were colluding to undermine and derail his presidency, and they were very successful at doing that, don't get prosecuted, you know, way after the fact, if they will even face any charges. And at this point, I mean, Hillary Clinton isn't even necessarily implicated, despite the fact that in this trial, who was it? Robbie Mook, I think, was one of her advisors or like worked for a campaign. He basically admitted that Clinton approved this from the top.
Sure.
And Sussman ran with it and ran to the FBI, and then it was leaked to the media, and sort of, you know, that's kind of how it spread at the beginning.
Right.
And so I mean, this was a totally fake narrative of Russian collusion.
Absolutely.
You know, again,
it's built out of a very real conspiracy that is documented, and all these things are, again, it's documented in the DNC emails leaked by Julian Assange, who remains in exile, probably going to be prosecuted for doing this, and Seth Rich died because of it. Murder still remains uninvestigated, let alone unsolved, and his parents will sue you if you try to investigate it. Sean Hannity found that the first time he tried to investigate anything, I think, in his life, and he almost took his show off the air. But the very real corruption in those DNC emails shows that the DNC was conspiring, and there's that word, conspiring to rob Bernie Sanders, who was the clear choice of the Democratic voters. He won 8 primaries in a row at one point, and all the media kept saying was Hillary's nomination is inevitable. It was ridiculous. But they document, this is what we're going to do. We're going to scheme, or we're going to cheat Bernie Sanders and install Hillary Clinton, the queen of the deep state.
Yep. And Bernie himself didn't even do anything about this. Yeah. Despite how obvious it was. Yeah.
Yeah. He blames the Russians too. And so they managed to twist all that into this narrative where Hillary becomes the victim rather than the beneficiary of a conspiracy. She becomes the victim of a collusion between Donald Trump and Russia. The whole thing it's the most absurd thing since the single bullet theory of the JFK assassination. It's totally ridiculous. And yet you've got millions and millions of people that believe it because they're willing to believe anything about Trump.
Yeah, it shows how evil these people are. I mean, the way they're able to lie and literally turn everything on its head, you know, turn everything upside down and get away with it. I mean, how much more evidence and proof do we need to demonstrate that the Clinton campaign and the crew around her are total political criminals?
Right.
And this was something that Trump was saying at the time, and you know, we're going to lock her up, you know, when I get in office. And of course that went nowhere.
Right.
And you know, this kind of ties into another piece that you wrote for this current issue of American Free Press about, you know, you sort of addressed Trump's increasingly less and less, I should add, is increasingly less and less America first populist rhetoric.
Yes.
Versus, you know, his actual record and accomplishments. Yeah. So what's his deal? Yeah, go ahead. Why don't you comment on this as well?
Yeah, well, this is I get in trouble with both sides in this because I'm a Trump agnostic, and we're the smallest minority group in the country, I think. I know Trump derangement syndrome is a real thing, and it's, you know, probably 60, 70 million people have it to one degree or another. And it's I don't know, what even know what it's based on, but it's a real mental illness. But there's also a lesser number of people that have what I call Trump enablement syndrome, where they continue to believe in the face of all evidence that they're awake to all the corruption. They know how bad the people in charge are doing, but they continue to believe that Trump is going to be the guy to save him. Even after he was president for 4 years, he didn't do anything he said he was going to do on immigration. And this is why he needed to. I said he was our last hope. He had to deport millions of people. He didn't try to. He deported fewer people than Obama, actually, under record, which is pretty pathetic. He didn't do anything except tweet. And what happened is he frittered away 4 years. He appointed one of the worst veterans of the deep state, William Barr, who goes back to covering up Ruby Ridge and Waco. He's a member of the Bush crime family. You think Trump didn't know that? That's the guy you're going to be in charge of draining the swamp? The only prosecutions Barr did the entire time he was in there were against Trump's friends, like Roger Stone, Paul Manafort, General Flynn, Jerome Corsi was almost raked in there too. People who did nothing wrong at all, except maybe not remember emails or something that any of us would do. But here you had these deep state villains like Hillary Clinton, Hunter Biden and Joe Biden, all these people with a laptop and all that. They did nothing. And you had the Durham report, and I wrote about this, where people kept expecting, and the Q people especially, the QAnon PSYOP that came out there and pacified people, wait 2 weeks and trust the plan and all that. Well, the plan didn't work too well, did it? But you had the Durham report. People were hanging so many hopes on that. And Barr crushed them near the end of the administration. He said, nope, we're not going to release it. There's no need to release it before the end. He knew if he had released it before Trump got out of office, maybe it would have made a difference if they could have had brought prosecutions really quickly. They didn't. And what are we, 2 years into this, and now you're hearing this one prosecution? I don't think this is going to make any change. Even if somehow Sussman is convicted, it's not going to, because he's not a big enough name. Hillary Clinton was convicted of something. That might make something. But there's this. It's a shame because Trump had this chance. He continues to endorse the wrong people largely. Dr. Oz, for instance.
Right. Yeah, that was part of your article as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he had the perfect populist MAGA candidate in that Pennsylvania Senate race, in the primary, the Republican primary, to endorse. Yes. that woman, Barnett, I believe was her last name.
Kathy
Barnett, yeah.
Kathy Barnett, who was a black woman, so you know, you try to reach new demographics, and she was saying all the right stuff. She was saying the Trump America First rhetoric. She was calling out. She talked about Dr. Oz and this guy McCormick, who's probably worse than Dr. Oz. Again, this is your Republican Party, folks. If you're listening out there, you think they're alternative, these are the people the Republican Party establishment backs, the Lindsey Graham types. McCormick is horrible. And Kathy Barnett pointed out that both of them had ties to the World Economic Forum. So either way, the establishment wins with either one of those guys. And I don't know, maybe Kathy Barnett wouldn't have been any good either. But she certainly was saying the right stuff. And Trump should have endorsed her. Instead, he badmouthed her.
Yeah, I was going to say, I saw his I follow him on Telegram now, and I saw his statements on Telegram where he was – I can't remember exactly what he said, but yeah, he was totally trashing her, saying that she could never defeat the Democrats, and she had a really shady, checkered background that she can't answer for. Was really like kind of saying some nasty things about her. And I don't even know much about this woman at all. I didn't really follow her campaign other than you know, my general understanding that she was like a big sort of MAGA-type candidate.
Yeah, well, she was saying the stuff that he should have reacted to if he was real, but he did. Trump did this throughout his presidency. Roy Johnson, people like that. Every time you had a candidate that was really saying the kinds of things he said when he ran in 2016, Trump would always back the rhino establishment. In many cases, and in an article I wrote earlier this year, I think it was this year or late last year, I think it was early this year, for American Free Press, I wrote about all the awful endorsements he's had. He's endorsed so many candidates who actually voted to impeach him.
He's even getting behind like Never Trumpers.
Yes.
Like that guy in Ohio, J.D. Vance. And there have been others. But you know, it's crazy. It's like you'd think that he would want to support and stand up with his biggest supporters, his biggest cheerleaders, especially when they're running for office. And yet he does the exact opposite. And really for me, I mean, I totally agree with your assessment of Trump. Really for me, the most unforgivable aspect of his presidency is watching what unfolded throughout the whole year of 2020.
Yeah.
With the pandemic, and then the lead up to the election, and the Black Lives Matter riots, the revolution,
yes.
the American color revolution that swept him from office. He did nothing, you know, except for tweet or do press releases or whatever. Yeah. He didn't do anything concrete.
Nope.
And, you know, it just totally exposed him for just the complete fraud that he is. And I don't know if he was, you know, an actor in on this, if, you know, or if he was just a weak individual or ultimately.
Either way.
It doesn't matter. Yeah, it doesn't matter at this point.
Either way.
I mean, really, he had all the potential in the world to clean house, to actually make some big time change.
It's our last chance.
To drain the swamp, as you used to say, to actually bring some of these high profile political criminals to justice, which again he talked openly about, to seriously deal with this whole great replacement, a topic that we'll get into shortly. Yeah, I wrote about that for American Free Press this week. But yeah, I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, he failed at every turn. And, you know, it does appear, I mean, I think you can make a good case. It's pretty hard to disagree that he was working against much of the political establishment, the media establishment. But he could have brought in competent, honorable, decent people to help him out. And he just never did that. He hired and worked with some of the biggest traitors and phonies in politics.
Who hated him. People
that were openly against his political agenda. So I guess what I'm saying is that at the end of the day, it's his own fault. And, you know, we can't make any more excuses for him. The buck stops with him, you know, as the saying goes for presidents.
Well, and the worst part is that what happened on the election is not only did you have outright fraud, which he, you know, he protested against and tweeted, but he put it in the framework of his ego, which he always does. I won by a landslide, all this nonsense. Look, you didn't win by a landslide no matter what. Half the country probably hates you. So I think you won. There was fraud, but it wasn't a landslide because the country's utterly divided. There's never going to be any kind of a landslide win for anybody, I don't think, as presidency anymore, because the country's utterly divided. But he had those people that he lured to D.C. under the Stop the Steal campaign that went there, including Ashley Babbitt, who came from California to be shot by a cop who was cheered in Congress about it, including stupid Republicans. Again, they're out. And Trump has said nothing. He says nothing about the January 6th defendants who are still in prison over a year later. They're absolute political prisoners. It's a crime that we should all be ashamed of. Nobody talks about it. Tucker Carlson nibbles around it here or there. Not a single civil libertarian.
It's a total disgrace. Yeah,
it absolutely is. Yeah. And he could be talking about that. He should lead off every rally talking about that. And he should be donating some of those millions he's raising at his rallies. He should be donating them so those people can hire real attorneys and get out of there, because this is what's happening to them. They've been denied due process. It violates every single tenet of the Bill of Rights, what's happening to them. And nobody cares. The ACLU is not concerned with civil liberties. They said, no, we're going to concentrate on racism.
Exactly.
They don't even care.
Yeah, it is really disheartening, disappointing, disillusioning. For sure. Because, again, I mean, he had all the potential in the world going into office.
Oh, yeah.
And it was just nothing but one big disaster.
I was excited. I mean, that inaugural address he gave was the best since JFK. It was incredible. I mean, that was – I thought, okay, maybe I hated the choice of Pence as vice president. And, you know, the people I'm hearing bandied about his choices for his cabinet, I don't like them. But that inaugural address was great. And – but, you know, he didn't sign the executive order the first day in office to end sanctuary cities and end birthright citizenship and end the H-1B visa program. All the stuff he promised to do, he never did that.
And he could have. Even if it would have cost him politically, if it would have,
right. You
know, pissed off all the Democrats and the media, which, of course, I mean, they already hated
him
anyways.
They accused him of doing – they basically accused him of doing that, and he never did it. So it's like, they already hate you. Actually try to do something and maybe you'll win some Congress, especially because if he hadn't done it, then you would have seen a real significant improvement in the quality of life. You know, just going to Home Depot in the morning and not seeing the third world that's out there looking for day work to be hired, you know, that kind of stuff.
You don't even got to go to Home Depot. You just got to walk down the street in any major city nowadays.
Right.
Well, there's a couple other articles I want to briefly get to before we wrap up. And the third article you wrote for this issue dealt with nepotism and corruption in D.C., a very important topic, and how virtually the entire federal government and both political parties are all in on it, especially senators and congressmen in D.C. You want to comment on this briefly?
Right. Well, you mentioned Joe Manchin earlier, and he's a perfect example. His daughter is the CEO of one of the big pharmaceutical giants. So, you know, she makes an incomprehensible amount of wealth, and she's not remotely qualified. As far as we can determine, she's about the only CEO of a Fortune 500 company in America that doesn't have an MBA. But, you know, her father's a big profile senator. So how when somebody – what's important here is the conflict of interest. So when Manchin comes up to vote on something, let's say he votes on health care issues, he's not going to factor that in, that his daughter – I mean, we all are going to vote. We're not going to do anything to hurt our children, are we? Nobody's going to do that. So he's not going to vote against that. And I gave many other examples of that as well, where these children congressmen are have big high profile jobs, and obviously that presents a conflict of interest. And if we still talk about nepotism, they go back to Jack Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy, where it was one of the good examples of nepotism, because Bobby Kennedy was probably the best attorney general he ever had. He actually tried to do something, but they still bring that up just because they were brothers. So there's nothing necessarily wrong with it on the surface, but something like this brings up when your children have those kind of interests that could obviously impact. I mean, if you're judges, what happens in those cases, you're supposed to recuse yourself. If there's, some, they say when a family member or something is related to that, should be the same thing for Congress. So people like Manchin, all this, they should not have the right to vote. That would be my solution. Maybe if you can't end the nepotism, anytime a vote comes up that could possibly impact his child or your close relative's income, let's say, then you can't. You have to recuse yourself. You recuse yourself from the vote, but you don't hear anybody.
That would take some honesty and integrity and decency for some of these members to display to actually do something like that. But no, this isn't even talked about. I mean, this isn't even really widely reported on. There are certain organizations in D.C. like think tanks and stuff that follow this and focus on this sort of issue, but it's not something that you read in major newspapers or see on Fox News or CNN. And you list, like, oh my gosh, it must be at least 20 different examples of high profile members of Congress, and either they're usually it's like one of their children that are either a big time lobbyist in D.C. or have used their political connections to advance their career. And you actually have a really good quote in here from a woman named Melanie Sloan, who's the executive director of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics. And she said, members of Congress basically are profit centers for their entire families.
Yeah.
Some people can get by solely on talent, but talent and connections is a much better combination. And if you have to have one or the other, it's probably the connections that you'd want to have. And you know what? This is something that I think most people probably realize, but they might not think about it, too much. But realizing, like, coming to the realization that this is actually how America works, realizing this fact of life was really one of the most devastating realizations in my entire life when I was when I was younger, like when I was in college. Yep. I mean, it totally shattered this notion of America as this meritocracy where anybody can work hard and achieve. And I mean, I guess you still can to a certain extent. I mean, I'm still going to work hard and pursue my.
Well, you have to try.
And try my hardest and stuff, and not let it hold me back. But
you can't give
this,
up.
This meritocracy idea is just out the window, especially at this point.
And that's really the main premise of my book, Survival of the Richest, which is one of my lesser read books. But it talks about not only the disparity of wealth, but the rigged system. Again, that's why I found it so appealing when Trump used that expression, because that's what I was talking about. The system is rigged. It's a rigged economy. It's a casino economy. And you have to have most of the people lose. And by lose, I mean, financially struggle for the people that are doing well to continue to do better. That's the only way you can improve the lot of most people without impacting some of the wealth that the people at the top have. And they don't want to give up anything. As Huey Long, my hero, said a long time ago, one of his many great quotes, he said, it's not enough for them to have everything. They have to know that you don't have it. And that's
it. It's almost like they have to rub it in your face and make a show of it. Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And so you're right. It's very disillusioning to understand not only do we have any kind of a meritocracy, but and this has been going on for a long time. And again, in my book, Survival of the Richest, I list actually, I think it wasn't included in the published version, so people would have to go to my blog, donaldjeffries.media, and they can find, going back in the archives, it goes back years, you can find deleted chapters from Hidden History and Survival of the Richest. And the Survival of the Richest chapter, I have celebrity connections there, and I talk about all of these incestuous relationships, that whether it's Hollywood or the political world, Fortune 500 companies, and I talk about how few people that we know as famous or even were famous in the past, I look at their backgrounds, and almost none of them came from anything less than upper middle class, most of them extreme wealth, tons of Mayflower descendants. And there you see that everywhere. People with congressmen as fathers that were in Hollywood, or judges things like that that are and that's the way the system works. There's very little upward mobility outside of maybe sports to some degree and maybe entertainment to a smaller degree, but it's a rigged system. Basically, if you're born poor in America, odds are you're going to die poor. And that shouldn't happen because you should have a chance at it, but the statistics are all in that book and you're seeing it bear out now. And it's just, they pretend otherwise, but it's just not the case, because remember, everybody doing the pretending, everybody that is on television, everybody that's in, you know, all the celebrities, everyone that has a large public platform, they're all in that 20% winning category somewhere.
Right.
So they're winning.
Well, and it's even worse now, like in the past maybe 30 years or so, because a lot of this now is like racially based, where racial preference is given to minorities or, yep. You know, sexual minorities, homosexuals, transgenders, immigrants. Yep. I mean, basically anybody but a white, you know, straight male, essentially. I mean, that's kind of what it boils down to. And this ties in perfectly to this media gaslighting campaign. Mm-hmm. About the great replacement fact of, you know, reality, like the actual policies that have been implemented to carry out this idea of a great replacement. And, you know, we saw this on vivid display in the aftermath of this alleged mass shooting in Buffalo, New York. I have a lot of questions and suspicions about, you know, as to the accuracy of this this narrative. It's very, very suspicious, to say the least. But yes. Needless to say, the media was running with this idea that this young man, Peyton Gendron, who displayed remarkable marksmanship, as always, in these alleged mass shootings. But anyways, they were saying that, you know, he was influenced by white supremacist ideas, by the notion of the Great Replacement, which mm-hmm. they've described as an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory. You know, and they you know, they immediately tried blaming Tucker Carlson and, you mm-hmm. know, white nationalists with these sorts of talking points for influencing this young man and, you know, basically instigating terrorism for having these sorts of thoughts and for talking about it openly mm-hmm. on Fox News and other platforms and sort of mainstreaming this idea of the Great Replacement, which more and more Americans are waking up to and recognizing. There was a recent public opinion poll that was conducted actually late in December of last year, but the results were just reported on earlier this year in early May, and 32% of U.S. adults recognize that Americans are basically being, like, native-born Americans are basically being displaced with immigrants. Mm-hmm. A lot of people think it's tied into the Democrat sort of agenda to, you know, get immigrants on, you know, into the country so they can start voting Democrat. Although I think it's even more sinister than that, frankly.
Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah. But anyways, this was a really interesting development. I mean, they will sit there and literally tell you, and this is typical, they will tell you the opposite of reality mm-hmm. and say that it's like this crazy, delusional conspiracy theory to talk about demographic statistics. At least if you notice it and are against it. If you're praising it, then it's fine, right? I mean,
right.
That's basically the way they handle it. And I've seen video. There have been a lot of videos that have come out recently, and there have been others, you know, even before this, showing like elite politicians, like Joe Biden, for example, bragging about how whites were losing their, you know, demographic majority in America, and mm-hmm. that and how that was such a great thing, such a wonderful right. thing that
wonderful.
You know, a positive development. Yeah. So, anyways, go ahead if you want to comment on this. This to me was a really important story this week.
No, yeah, absolutely. And I'm not afraid to talk about the Great Replacement. I mean, you can say it's a conspiracy theory that somebody's plotting to do it. Well, regardless of any of that, it's happening. It's undeniable. And they're bragging about it. And you're right. And they're basically smearing any white person who dares to object to his kind, the people who look like him, dying out. I mean, if there's like a butterfly in Tahiti or something that's in danger, the entire world moves. Oh, we have to do something about that. But here you have the Caucasian race, who has been responsible for most of the good and bad in the history of civilization. I mean, you know, let's face it, they've been the most dominant race, and they're responsible for all the great, most all the great inventions. But yeah, they're responsible for a lot of horrible things too, you know, genocide warmongering and so forth, because the wrong people are always in charge. But still, to not be concerned that they are dying out, and they are. And but to be celebrating and to see white people, so this is what you would never see, a Chinese crowd cheering and going crazy, and Chinese spokesmen celebrating the fact that the Chinese are dying out,
right?
Or the Koreans, or
when the U.S. Census for 2020 information was released. This was just last year. I think it was Jimmy Fallon, you know, like the late night comedian.
Yes.
He was sort of joking about it, like, oh, this is like, you know, a good thing. Like, America is like the whites are losing power in America and we're being replaced, essentially, is what he said. Yeah. And everybody starts like the crowd starts laughing. And who knows, you know, how fake that is. But just the fact that you can get up and joke about it and celebrate it as a good thing.
Yeah.
On the other hand, you know, demonizing anybody who's noticing it or questioning it or is opposed to it, which to me is a very legitimate and rational perspective to hold, especially if you're white.
Yes.
You know, I got to read just one brief excerpt here from this article. I write here, to the elites running America and the Western world, those who notice and object to the systematic replacement of the white demographic are considered violent extremists and demonized as potential terrorists. Meanwhile, political pundits and consultants, politicians, comedians, and other talking heads openly celebrate the browning of America and the decreasing white demographic, praising the changing demographics as a moral, just, and wonderful development for America and the Western world. Where else is this happening? This is not happening anywhere except for Western European countries, the United States, Canada, Australia, to a much lesser extent. But this to me is just, this is really like one of the most important issues out there. And for the way the media can get up there and just, again, it's like these people are so evil, they can just totally flip it and act like it's like this dangerous, crazy, you know, potentially violent conspiracy theory that's going to lead people to go out and commit, you know, acts of mass violence and you know, public shootings and stuff like that.
Right.
Yeah, it's just, it's outrageous. Well, go ahead.
Well, no, I mean, and it has to be confronted for what it is. There is an anti-white element to everything that's happening. And white people are embracing it and largely pushing it. Most of the people that are pushing this agenda are not black. There's white people are still largely in charge. And so they're the one, and the crowd you see, when you see those really crazed people, the Antifa people, and the that you see it when Owen Schroyer and Alex Jones used to go out in those crowds and try to talk to the pussy hat wearers and all that, they are almost all white. The ones that are vile, I mean, you see a few blacks, but they're black, they're doing their own thing. The ones that really are the hate whitey stuff and talk about white supremacy and stop your white male dot privilege and all that, those are all whites, mostly white women. And
there's a lot of Jews involved as well. But yeah.
But I mean, I look at that differently maybe than you or anybody else, because I found it ironic when Whoopi Goldberg, and of course I defended her right to free speech, I defend everybody's free speech, when she made that very innocuous comment about the Holocaust wasn't about race or something like that, which was very innocuous, wasn't controversial at all. But they jumped all over because, and what do we see? We see people on the far right that think the Jews are behind everything. They don't think Jews are white, but they think they're, you know, they're. But we know that in this case, apparently the Jews don't think they're white either, because they were very offended by that.
Oh, yeah, and, you know, to the point where she was suspended. Yeah, she was suspended for a couple of weeks.
So we need to look at it, because, I mean, I think there's so many mixed marriages and stuff. There's so many people that are – I have tons and tons of relatives on my mother's side. One of my mom's sisters married a Jewish guy that became a Catholic. But so most of my relatives are partially Jewish, because they're all Catholics. None of them practice Judaism. But so – and you have tons and tons, millions and millions of Americans like that now that are partially Jewish and stuff. So – I think that to say that they're not white, that's just ridiculous. There's no question that there's a disproportionate number of Jewish names that we find behind these things.
Well, and it's really to me even more importantly is actually like the role that the organized Jewish community plays in this. Groups like the ADL, the Jewish Committee. I mean, there are a wide variety of organized Jewish groups explicitly operating openly as Jewish groups, as advancing Jewish interests. Like, that's what they're dedicated to. And these are some of the primary proponents of diversity and mass immigration,
right,
and all sorts of other very destructive policies. But
I think we need to confront them with their own language, because when they say things like diversity, we need to fight back and say, you mean like the NFL and the NBA? You consider that diverse. It's not diverse.
Right.
12% of the population is 80% of the players. So,
well, diversity, yeah, so, I mean, like, diversity is literally just a code word for, like, less white people.
That's
all it is, yeah.
That's exactly what it is. It means less whites. But we need to point that out. And nobody does. And say, you know, by that, how do you mean diversity? That's why I'm trying to get, I tweeted it out earlier this week. I would like to start something to say we should either come up with something like white shaming. So whenever anybody says anything bad, say, oh, you're white shaming again. Sometimes you need to appropriate their stupid language from them, and or, you know, something like white phobia or something like that, because this is they get a lot of mileage out of these absurd terminology like, you know, homophobia, like that people fear gays or something, which is a totally inappropriate term. But they get a lot of mileage out of that, or fat shaming. So let's, you know, take it that because you can't. I am not any white nationalist. I may sound like it a lot of times. I am an equal. I'm non-racist. I take the non-racist position all the time. But the problem is it's perceived as racist because I'm not apologizing for being white. I feel no guilt about being white. I've never done anything wrong to other people. I try to treat everybody decently. So I'm not going to, and I don't think my ancestors did either, because I traced my genealogy and they were all really poor. I don't think they could have discriminated. They didn't have the power to discriminate. And that's the way most white people are that live today. But people instead, they hang their heads in shame. They apologize for it. No, you've got to stop doing that, because this is why we're at the position we're at. Because, and again, it's not saying white people and, you know, we're superior or anything like that, but we're not inferior. And we all need to be treated with respect. And right now, there's no question that there is, whether you call it the Great Replacement Theory or whatever, that they are pushing this notion that fewer whites everywhere is something to celebrate. And as a white person who has white children and hopes to have grandchildren that will probably be white one day, I really resent that. And I don't know how other white people out there don't feel the same way. Do you not care about your kids? Do you not want them to have a good life? Are you just basically saying they should? I mean, I don't understand this. It's foreign to me, but America, that's the situation. Millions and millions of people have been totally brainwashed.
Right. Yeah. No, well said. Well, that's the result of, yeah, propaganda and media manipulation, media gaslighting, and totally weaponized anti-white narratives of history. I mean, we can go on and on. And I mean, again, think about it. Whites are the only group of people not allowed to organize politically or even socially or culturally,
right,
to talk about their interests, to try to figure out what's best for whites. Meanwhile, all these other minorities being welcome into our country are openly organizing politically, organizing in the U.S. Congress. I mean, what, they have the Latino caucus, the Black caucus, the Jewish caucus. I mean, it goes on and on and on. And yet, you know, white people are the only group that isn't allowed to do this and isn't allowed to openly talk about what's good for whites, what's in our interests, what's not in our interests, and, you know, sort of frame the discussion that way. It's really it's really unfair. I mean, really, if you think about it, like, politics is you know, it's like a big struggle for power, and white people are the only group of people not openly organized and involved in the fight. We're just sitting on the sidelines getting trampled.
Right. And you can't have a situation where other groups, especially blacks, are encouraged to revel in their race. And everything is about their race. Their entire identity is built around what color they are, or what ethnicity they are. But white people cannot mention race at all, cannot mention even being white, unless it is to denigrate themselves, to self-hate, and to demand that more rights be taken from them and their children. That's insanity. You can't have a dialogue about race. A dialogue about race is a bunch of white virtue signalers egging on black radicals to talk about how everything's racist, and no whites allowed to defend. There's no defense at all. There's no counter argument at all. There's no discussion. It's a diatribe, and we're supposed to accept it and just say, sure, you know, just take away more of our rights, bring on the reparations. And, you know, somebody – we need another side. The only one in the mainstream at all that fights back at all to any degree is Tucker Carlson, to the degree he does when he does it. There's nobody else. Is there anybody in Congress, Marjorie Taylor Greene, maybe a handful of people that kind of do, but not really.
Not explicitly as white, framing it from like a pro-white, pro-American perspective, right? I mean, it's never explicitly pro-white. The one thing in politics that you can't be pro-white in American politics and have any sort of career.
No, absolutely not. Nope, that's for sure.
So, well, Don, I think we will wrap it up with that. Thank you very much for joining me. This was a good conversation. We covered a lot of territory, and I think we made a lot of really good points. This whole great replacement thing is really crazy, and the alleged mass shootings are even more incredible.
Well, we don't have time to talk about it, but if people want to, they can check out. I just wrote an article today. It's getting good feedback about the latest one in Texas. A lot of dubious elements to it. People can check it out at donaldjeffries.media. I write there regularly for Substack, so it's I have some very controversial comments to make about that, but don't take anything at face value.
I am going to go read that right now, actually, because I follow your Substack via email, and I saw the post that you made. I haven't had a chance to read it, but I will definitely do that. Cool. And of course, everybody check out AmericanFreePress.net and consider subscribing to the paper if you're not already. And Don, thanks, man. I appreciate it. We'll do this again in the near future.
Always fun. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Thanks, man.
Take care.
Bye.
Okay, bye.